Steve, I have that piece of paper. How's your recovery going?
This may set it back.
Was it on your, was it a back?
No, my hip.
May it please the court, my name is Howard Scher and I represent the Federal Bureau of Prisons. In this case, management has the right to decide which posts are included in rosters on a quarterly basis, and that is its management right under 5 U.S.C. 7106A. Article 18, which the parties negotiated, addresses the procedures for making the assignment of employees to those posts. The issue here is whether this initiative that was named the Mission Critical Initiative changed anything about those procedures and thus changed a condition of employment for the employees.
When did this become, when was the Mission Critical Initiative first unveiled?
Started perking up in late 2004, and then we have in the record the Vanier Memorandum of December 2004.
What page is that?
And that would be in the opinion of the arbitrator at page 2 and 3, where he quotes that. We didn't separately put the memorandum in the record.
There are a lot of things missing from this record, but from my 2 and 3.
It would be, I'm sorry, Your Honor, it would be pages
how about
16 and 17
right, okay.
of the joint appendix and 2 and 3 of the arbitrator's
right, so
decision.
So where should I look on 16? For the first outcropping.
So it's right in the middle of the page, on page 16, shortly before Director Lappin's 2005, January 2005 message, there was a December 2004 memorandum from Vanier to the wardens at various institutions.
That's what follows, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
That's what follows in the block.
Correct, yes.
Well, it says, likewise, captains were instructed to create a new quarterly roster to be reviewed and approved. That's part of the Mission Critical Initiative, right? That instruction.
That instruction goes to, yes, they were instructed to look at their rosters, to create rosters in.
Okay, well, if a memorandum of December 23rd says captains were instructed to do this, then the Mission Critical Initiative must predate 1223, correct?
Well, it was perking in the 2004 period up till 2004's memorandum. Yes, and in this regard,
an earlier reference to when did it first appear? This, I think, is the first appearance that I could find in the record.
Yes, and the
it contemplates some earlier issuance, but I can't find.
Well, and this memorandum was a reference to the creation of rosters that had inadvertently or incorrectly fail to include posts that were required by other national policy. And so this reference by Vanier that is quoted by the arbitrator has to do with the instruction to various wardens to resubmit their rosters they had previously submitted.
The ones they'd previously submitted, which erred in that they contradicted established policy, they had submitted under an instruction to implement the Mission Critical Initiative.
As far as the record is concerned, that's not clear.
I agree. I can't.
And the record seems to start with, as far as the union submissions and the government submissions, with this memorandum and then the Lappin.
So at some point, or some point, most likely in 2004, I guess, sometime.
Yes, and one of the things we cited is the attachment F, which had a bunch of individual arbitrations and or grievances submitted to regional directors, and that was cited in our brief. Those, I think, were the result of the perking up of the mission-critical concept, so that you had a lot of separate challenges to decisions by wardens regarding individual rosters at individual institutions, all of which were either dismissed by the regional director or withdrawn by the union as a result of...
Can you give a date that's any earlier than this that we can...
Not that the record shows and not that I'm aware of.
When was the collective bargaining agreement in the appendix, I think, says on its face that it's the 1998 to 2001 agreement. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So that wasn't even the agreement in force then in 2004, was it?
Well, it continues. There was no new master agreement after that.
But is it renewed by its own terms if there's no successor agreement?
By the force of, yes. So by the force of, I think, authority law as well as parties agreement.
So that was in effect at the time.
It continues in effect, yes.
And its renewal would have been sometime in 2004, three years after?
Well, it continues as a viable contract between the parties until the parties come up with a new contract.
It's not renewed by rollover for periods of 3 years?
No.
Even though the contract bar expires, or does it in the public sector expire at 3 years?
I don't know. It technically had a term of 3 years, but the parties were unable to agree on a subsequent master agreement, and therefore the terms of the original three-year master agreement just simply continue in force until a new master agreement is agreed to by the parties. And so it remains in effect even now because the parties have not agreed to a new master agreement.
So when the union first got word of the, or first got any information about the Mission Critical Initiative, pardon me, there was an agreement in effect, and it had not been, it was not renewed at any time thereafter. It
was not renegotiated or changed or modified in any way. So Article 18 remained the guiding principle upon which management's right to assign work was implemented by way of agreement. So management has the right to assign work. Unions have a right to negotiate over procedures and adverse effects or impact and implementation bargaining, and Article 18 is that part of the contract, which spells out those procedures.
Is it your understanding of the covered by rule? I the parties agree that's what the issue is here, whether the covered by rule applies.
I think that's it.
Okay. Is it your understanding of that rule that if a matter has significant unforeseen consequences, if an employer action that is authorized by the contract nonetheless has significant unforeseen consequences for the employees, that the employer is obligated to bargain over I&I?
Let me put it in this context. If the union's position is that there were significant adverse consequences resulting from management's initiative, and I think this mission and critical moniker has created the problems, the fact of the matter is the covered by doctrine applies. If it applies, and prevents...
Regardless of the consequences.
Regardless. So that
it can be unforeseen, they can be significant, but if the management's entitled to do it, it doesn't have to bargain over implementation.
That is exactly right, Your Honor.
So when does it have to bargain over I&I?
So, for example, had our mission critical said, we want wardens to give only 3 weeks' notice instead of the 7 weeks. Seven's in the contract. That would have required bargaining.
It would have required substantive bargaining.
It would have required impact and implementation of bargaining over the change in the procedures or the conditions of employment.
But you could unilaterally make that change?
We could not. We would have to bargain over that.
That is an impact bargaining. That's just a violation of the agreement, right?
Well, we could propose that to the union and say we're contemplating changing or because of emergency reasons or whatever, making the roster process 3 weeks long instead of 7 weeks. The union would say we need to bargain over that, and then we would be in violation of the statute if we failed to bargain.
But you wouldn't be bargaining over its impact. You would be bargaining over whether you can do it.
Well, we'd be bargaining over essentially an impact vis-a-vis management's right. Management has the right to assign work. We have procedures in place dealing with that, Article 18. Now we're trying to change Article 18 under the hypothetical I've posed. To change that, we would have to negotiate because we would be changing a condition of employment or a term of the contract.
What's an example of then of bargaining over the impact of a change, but not over the change?
Well, the union would, we'd still have the rosters, which would in essence involve the question of wardens implementing their right to decide which blank posts, which posts will go in the roster. The impact of reducing from 7 weeks to 3 weeks, for example, might have
a violation of the CBA.
It would be.
What we're looking for is something that is permissible under the CBA, but under the precedents requires impact bargaining.
Well, in the sense that this is. One of the problems that I think that this case has is this is squarely, so squarely covered by, in our view, that to look for the hypotheticals that the court is requesting is a bit difficult. But I do think
sort of get the doctrine straight.
Right, and the doctrine simply is if the contract covers the subject matter of a particular proposal by the union, then, as this court is well aware, there's no duty to engage in midterm bargaining. It may be that my hypothetical may be slightly off the mark, and I can't think of a better hypothetical that might, in fact, at this point, fill the court's thinking on this, but it might have been, instead of a 7 week process, a different management committee. I don't know.
Let me ask this a different way. As I understand it, the agency has certain management prerogatives, and if it falls within that category, it's not something that they need to bargain about. I guess my first question is, are these management prerogatives things that might be included in the collective bargaining agreement?
Only as a permissive subject of bargaining. In other words, management...
You don't have to do it, but you might cover it if the agency just wanted to do so.
Correct. So this management right to assign, as the authority says on page 31 of its brief, is our right. And there is no bargaining over that. Management does not have to bargain over that issue.
Right. So is that, in fact, included in the collective bargaining agreement? It's not.
No, because that is the management right. The only thing that's in the agreement is the 7106B2, 7106B3, the impact and implementation bargaining, which is Article 18.
But so it would always be the case, though, that if you exercise this management prerogative, the union could request impact and implementation bargaining, right?
At a point in which there is no provision that already covers the impact and implementation.
Okay. See, this is what's confusing about trying to figure out what's going on here. If your management prerogatives are not covered by the CBA, then wouldn't the union always be able to request impact and implementation bargaining?
No, because at the beginning of the contract, 1998, we had a right to assign employees established by the statute. And the union decided to bargain, as it had the right to, over how those assignments would be made, the procedures, the impact and implementation. Once that was covered by the contract, there was no more bargaining over that.
Your contention essentially is that the portions of the CBA after, I think it's 18D2, which is where the employer does the posting, all that is the impact and implementation of what the employer does under 18D2.
Well, and the posting as well is part of that, because what the posting requires is a blank sheet with that is blank to the extent that employees' specific names of employees are not included.
Okay.
And the blank includes the posts that are going to be filled.
But that's That's sort of very clearly an exercise of management prerogative, right?
That part is.
It's saying what work has got to be done. And then everything thereafter in 18D, I guess, I'm not sure the structure is very peculiar, deals with the implementation of those choices. Is that correct?
Well, it depends on where you're. I just want to say the actual posting of the roster 7 weeks in advance, which may be where you're starting, is part of the implementation.
Okay. I accept the modification.
Okay. And then that's, and then everything else deals with.
It's failing after.
So the implementation is in the contract?
Yes. The implementation of the right to assign is what Article 18 embodies. And that's our basic position. That's the position. Well, the authority agrees that that's management's prerogative to choose which posts should be filled.
If 18D implements management right to assign work, is there anything about impact in the contract? Perhaps the clearance time between shifts or something like that might qualify.
How
many hours would change?
Well, I think the impact in part has to do with 7 weeks in advance. This allows the employees time to arrange their lives. And by knowing which posts they might be assigned to, that whole process is intended to give employees the ability to meet their obligations on their non-work side by giving 7 weeks in advance. And so forth. So that you will have seen maybe in the joint appendix concerns about child care, et cetera.
Now you're going from a situation where they have 7 weeks to plan what their new schedule will be for the next 3 months, right? To plan their outside lives in order to accommodate their new work schedule, to a new situation in which that new work schedule may be highly erratic and change from day to day, and they don't know.
But that always was the case, because there always was a sick and annual post, the floater post. And employees knew that based on Article 18, it was always up to the warden to decide. Let me use the 100 employee example I used in the brief. If before Mission Critical started, whenever we could agree that started, there were 80 specific job titles and 20 sick and annual. After Mission Critical at a particular institution, it might have reduced to 65, 35.
Okay, now.
But that's not frozen in stone.
Okay, but now let's say the top 40 employees in seniority never got on the floater schedule. They always had enough clout to bid for a fixed post. That's changed for some of them now, right?
No, everybody always had
sick and annual. There aren't now enough spots. I'm sorry, everyone goes through.
Everybody went through sick and annual posts. If you read 18, before. I think G, okay. Everybody rotated through that at least at one point. Yeah. Who was an employee could expect.
Yeah, I noticed you didn't argue 18G as part of your covered by argument.
Well, we argued between 18 generally and 18D specifically, but 18 is the entire article, and 18G is the one that points out the sick and annual rotation system. And then there's 18O through R, which are the exceptions to all the timelines, 24 hours notice in certain situations, 2 weeks notice in other situations for changes. So, for example, there could be a 2 week notice in the change, a 24-hour change in an assignment or a particular shift change on a temporary basis, so forth.
Okay, so then what does the Vanier memorandum change?
In our mind, it changes nothing except to give guidance.
And it was unnecessary.
Well, it gave guidance to.
I know in government that happens. But we don't.
Essentially, there was a funding issue because of congressional funding had either reduced or it was expected to be reduced. And simply stated, had the Vanier memorandum said, This is a wardens take a hard look at your rosters because of budget reasons. I think we wouldn't be here, but for some...
In fact, it lapses into more coercive instruction, doesn't it?
There is language in there that I think the authority misunderstands in terms of this instruction to wardens to not eliminate, that was on page 16 and 17, the joint appendix, not eliminate posts that they can't eliminate because of national policy.
Well, they should eliminate certain specified examples, right, like a second chapel warden, custodian.
I think the words should, suggested, guidelines are heavily stated throughout, and the arbitrator notes them.
In your theory, does that make any difference?
Well, it does because part of 18D requires the warden to be the final...
It says the employer, right?
But the final part of 18D, it's on page 78, I believe, of the joint appendix, says it's the warden who must make the final decision.
But then how did the regional manager get into the picture?
That started out as a statement in the memorandum that was corrected. That's why on page 3...
That's rescinded in the correction?
That's why the arbitrator at page 17 says... it's the second full paragraph at the top. Additional posts will not be added to the mission critical quarterly roster without the approval of the respective regional director, subsequently amended to respective warden. And that was based on the record in the case, which showed that although perhaps an early memorandum indicated that regional directors would make these decisions, the arbitrator determined that in fact wardens still continue to make the decision as they did before mission critical and as they did afterwards. And that's required by, or is consistent with the requirement in the contract. It's number 6 on page 78 that says the roster will be forwarded to the warden for final approval. So any direction, guidance, or et cetera from above by senior management couldn't have removed the warden as the final arbiter.
Now, would there be some institution?
D2 says 7 weeks prior, the employer, and that does not seem to disaggregate the Bureau of Prisons at all.
Is the employer defined in the agreement?
It's defined in the preamble. But the fact of the matter is, both parties were aware that captains acting on behalf of the wardens created the rosters and that the wardens finally approved it as required by the provision I cited to you. So yes, employer is used throughout, and it would indicate perhaps that senior management could make certain decisions, but in fact, the final decision regarding every roster is made by the warden, which is why the so-called mission critical initiative didn't remove from wardens the authority to approve rosters and determine which.
But didn't the arbitrator make a specific finding that in fact this Vanier memorandum included specific instructions?
Well, he did, and that's the part which I, in our reply brief, point out is the instruction to wardens to resubmit quarterly rosters that had erroneously eliminated the perimeter patrol, because the perimeter patrol is required by some other national policy, a correctional manual, a correctional services manual, for example, I think. But in the end, note that the arbitrator says very specifically that I'm not imposing the status quo anti-remedy because wardens could do what Vanier suggested. And I think that's, among other terms in the arbitrator's decision, a key to our position, and we think the correct characterization of what the mission of critical initiative comprised. So,
do you know, or does the record reflect, or could there be in principle institutions within the system that would not need to make any of these roster adjustments in order to live within their budget?
It could have been. There's no record on it. But that's why I want to emphasize that somehow the arbitrator, the union, and the authority appear to see this.
Is there an institution-by-institution budget?
Yes, I believe so.
So if that's the constraint the warden's under, he or she might need to do this, might not, might do it to one degree or another in order to get...
Let me make sure on that, Your Honor. And I'll, yes. It is institution by institution. So that's why I give the example of the 80-20 split that might reduce to 65-35, but it might go back to 80-20 depending on the needs of the institution.
Two things about that. One is there's a sort of backhanded definitional section on page 34 of the joint appendix, which says the Bureau of Prisons and Federal Prison Industries hereinafter referred to as the employer or the agency. So it would seem under that that the word employer at page 76 means the Federal Bureau of Prisons, putting aside Prison Industries, Inc. But I thought I understood you to say that there was sort of a gloss on employer, as it appears here at D2, to mean the captain, which is, an associate of the warden,
right.
A subordinate of the warden.
The highest-ranking correctional officer at the institution.
So if that's the gloss on employer there, then if there were a shift of discretion to central, it would be a violation of the agreement before you even get to the question of impact bargaining. No?
It sounds right. Yes.
It is right. I see. Okay. So it's essential to your argument that the Vanier memo and whatever came before and after left discretion in the hands of the warden.
And it's because of the D6 provision on 78 where the warden makes the final determination with respect to the roster that's assignments. We didn't want, I don't want the court to make any mistake about that. The Mission Critical Initiative did not want to remove the authority that always existed under 18. It wasn't trying to modify what was always the authorities that 18 granted to management to make assignments in accordance with the Article 18 procedures.
With that in mind, what if the Vanier memo, instead of saying what it did say, had said, to the extent that thrift requires, you may list all posts as sick and annual? What would the result be there?
It's the same, and our theory covers all the way to that, too, that an individual warden could, if he or she wanted, have 100, using my hypothetical number, 100 sick and annual. Of course, the problem there is you're going to have labor strife and so forth, so it's not in the best interest to have that kind of roster, but it's not precluded under our theory.
One of the theories is that somehow or other, making the union the exclusive bargaining agent itself averts labor strife. Whether that's a sound premise.
Morale problems, I suppose.
Well, morale problems.
But I think at each institution, and this is important, you might have a different split between specified and not. It may be 80-20 one quarter and 75-25 another quarter and back to 80-20. There's nothing, this is a fluid process, and there was nothing about Mission Critical that said it's always going to be 65-35 at every institution after this. That initiative, which may have been better named Take a Hard Look at Your Rosters initiative, should indicate that each quarter was a different quarter in terms of what the warden would implement vis-a-vis the split between specified titles and posts and the sick and annual post.
Okay, further questions?
As to the second question, we rely on our brief on the second question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah, I'll walk out.
Good Morning. May it please the court. I am Joyce Friedman, and I'll be representing the Federal Labor Relations Authority.
Could you turn your attention to this issue that has, at least in my mind, become much more prominent in light of the recent argument? And of course, we don't have the whole Vanier memo before us, but can you point to some words in the record that represent a decision by Central, I'll call it, a decision by Central divesting wardens and captains of some of their pre-existing authority?
Besides the Vanier's memo, which...
Is there anything in the Vanier memo that does it?
The Vanier's memo says that regional directors shall make these type of mission-critical changes, and also the director...
What are you pointing to exactly?
Okay. In the joint appendix...
I see it does. Posts will not be added to mission-critical quarterly roster without the approval of... Oh, but that's changed.
But
it says respective regional director, but then...
But it says
take it by finding of the arbitrator. It's the warden.
But
so no, that doesn't get you there.
Well, but in the record, there's testimony by the union. I believe he's now the legislative head of the union, but he was involved in bargaining over this contract, and he said that. In effect, in the regions, although this memo said that it was changed, that wardens now had the discretion, that wasn't done in the field, and that these blank rosters were regularly sent to the regional directors. And as
and
for the
be
exact...
sent to the regional directors for monitoring, right? The proposition they were sent to the regional directors doesn't... establish that the regional director controlled the contents.
Well, I think the regional director had the approval. In 18D6, the warden has final approval over the rosters that
right.
are eventually
I understand
set
that.
Up. But the regional director apparently in the region still had the ultimate say, and it is in the transcript.
What establishes that?
I'm sorry?
What is it that establishes that?
The evidence in the record that the testimony that was not disputed by or argued against by the agency. And it was Mr. Glover's testimony. And if you could bear with me for a minute.
Sure, I think it's 307. Bottom left and top right.
Thank you, Judge Ginsburg. Yes, it says starting at the transcript at 535, but again, Mr. Vanier did send out a memo saying that approval for rosters is at the warden's level, didn't he? Well, that was long after this, is my understanding. But nevertheless, he corrected this. I don't have that memo. We can get it for you. But I can tell you that in the field, it was not corrected. So that's where that comes from. But getting back to our main argument, as found by the arbitrator in his fact findings, management made significant changes with adverse consequences to the working conditions of BOP employees by implementing the Mission Critical Initiative. And these adverse changes impacted the safety and well-being of BOP employees, as found by the arbitrator in his fact findings. And the arbitrator's fact findings were not accepted by the agency, so these findings are not in dispute.
Can I ask you what... These findings about the stories told by people about what happened in the prisons with morale, danger, and so on, do they go to the covered by point or to something else?
Well, it goes to whether something can be bargained over the impact and implementation.
Well, it shows that there's an impact.
It shows that it's an impact, and it also shows that a change occurred that 18D didn't anticipate.
Well, that's what an impact means. Okay, so it shows an unforeseen impact, is what you're
saying. Right, unforeseen impact.
Right, so doctrinally, if there's an agreement that an employer may do X, and they does so for years and years, and then within the framework of X does it differently, changes the way it does X, with unforeseen consequences, does that require bargaining over implementation?
Well, then the covered by doctrine comes into play, and
well, it's covered by. My hypothesis is that it's covered by in the sense that the agreement says you may do this, and it's done it, but it's just changing the way it does it.
Well, according to case law, like Marine Corps and NTEU, if something is an authority for having a new thing done, if something can be read into the article in the collective bargaining agreement, then it is covered by. If it can't, if it's not the authority for, it could never have been contemplated that this new thing that's coming up, then it is not covered by. And I think that's what happened here.
And the heart of the authority's position is that it's the shift from warden to central of this discretion that makes it a, and actually, I mean, you don't, on the reading that I guess the agency agrees on, that's just flat out a violation of the CBA. Right?
Right.
So it's essential to the authority's position that there be this, that the memos and so forth wrought such a shift. And once it did so, if it did so, we don't have to get into it. Covered by is not in question. Impact and implementation are not in question. The whole thing's a flat-out violation of the CBA.
Well, the argument is that 18D covers it because it deals with procedures. It deals
with the implementation of the
rosters.
Warden's designation of rosters.
No. Right? It really deals, it doesn't deal with the warden's, 18D doesn't deal with the warden's, 18D does not deal with the warden's coming up with posts for rosters.
I mean, that's an interpretive question, right?
Right.
And just as preemption issues, which invoked by Judge Ginsburg in the NTEU case, there's interpretation of the statute in question, and sometimes the silence controls, right? But on the theory you're advancing now, it seems to me we don't get into that at all. If it's essential to your claim that there's this shift of authority, then you win without regard to all this doctrinal stuff. And if there isn't, you lose without regard to all this doctrinal stuff. Is that right?
Well, I'm not quite understanding your question.
You both agree that the CBA vests in the warden, together with the captain, but apparently we're not worried about that, this discretion about posting the roster, what's to be on the roster, right? If that's unilaterally shifted to central, then we have a violation of the CBA, right? On the other hand, the central is just saying, this is something you really ought to be worried about when you're making these decisions. You don't.
Okay.
No, okay, is that correct?
Yes. Yes, that wasn't argued in this case.
Well, your brief says that the agency is trying to turn this whole mission Christian critical initiative into mere guidance, or maybe that was the union's brief, but then saying that's not what it was. It was really a...
It was an instruction.
It was an instruction. Now, if you're
change.
So if you're wrong about that, don't you lose?
No, because the instruction...
You're right about it. Do you win?
I think in this case, it deals with a big sweeping initiative that changed the way employees, it had very, very bad consequences to the employees.
That's I understand the consequences and the unforeseen nature of them, but it seemed to me that that was the second issue that arises only if the first one is met, that there's some change that isn't covered by the contract. You can't, seems to me, say, it's not obvious at least, that one can say what the contract covers by asking whether there are unforeseen consequences.
The contract did not cover this mission critical because before mission critical, what the contract did cover was just the procedures of management and the union getting together.
But you agree that the wardens always had the authority to make these roster assignments, correct?
No, the warden doesn't make the roster assignments.
Well, in other words, say what the posts are.
Blank roster.
The blank roster. They always could do that, right?
The warden could always do that, but what changed here was the discretion of the warden had changed because of the mission critical initiative.
Well, so that's to say it was coercive, right?
That whether or not this was coercive. But let's say that BOP simply said, we have a budget problem. Everybody's going to have to reduce their overtime by 20%. You know, you do it however you think best. Here's an example of how one warden has handled this problem. Would you be here? Could you make the same argument?
Well, the mission critical, what happened with the elimination of posts and putting more people on the sick and annual and the whole initiative, that didn't that wasn't covered by any part of the collective bargaining agreement. It wasn't covered by 18D. And let me just give you an example. If only the union had the opportunity to engage in impact and implementation bargaining, it could have bargained over proposals that could have especially ameliorated the safety concerns of the employees, such as proposals for more training or uniform allowances for non-custodial employees who were suddenly forced to take custodial posts that were within contact with the prison population for the first time. These sorts of proposals are clearly not addressed by the procedural provisions in 18D, and this indicates that 18D was not all about the sweeping nationwide mission critical initiative, or that 18D could cover the mission critical initiative. And
well,
that's what the...
What I'm asking, though, is you characterize this as an initiative, but if they had done it a different way, which clearly did not direct the wardens to do this specifically, but simply said, you know, you're going to have to reduce your expenditures. Mm-hmm. Here's one way to do it. You do it however you see fit.
Okay, then what you would have to do is look at the impact. If there is something more than a de minimis impact, if this new proposal...
So even if it wasn't a nationwide initiative, and even if it wasn't being driven from the top, your argument would be you nevertheless would be entitled to impact and implementation bargaining, right?
Yeah, by looking at you know, things like if there was more than a de minimis impact, if it was reasonable, foreseeably reasonable that these changes would affect something, then you would have impact and implementation bargaining.
So it really doesn't matter.
Let's go back to your covered by theory. So I understand it, if there is any issue that comes up during the course of the collective bargaining agreement that isn't explicitly covered by the collective bargaining agreement, it's not covered by.
No, because there's a second prong, and that is it. There's two tests to the covered by doctrine.
Right.
One is that it has to be, if it's explicitly covered by,
right,
then it's covered by. But there's a second prong, and that's the prong that the agency concedes that it's not explicitly covered by. But the second prong is that the subject has to be inextricably bound with the collective bargaining agreement article.
It's basically a notion that by implication, the agreement has assigned authority somewhere, right?
That the agreement has some authority?
Has assigned authority, presumably to some component of management,
mm-hmm,
right?
But where is it in the agreement?
Just on the doctrinal point, mm-hmm, do you agree with that reading of inextricably bound?
Well, I'm sorry, I'm not quite understanding your point.
Well, the first hypothesis is that the agreement spells it out exactly what,
mm-hmm,
is going on. And we don't have to get into this because we have employer does something in violation of that, it's violating the CBA, end of case.
And that's not the claim here.
Mm-hmm. And then the question is, what does it's inextricably bound, but it seems to me it boils down to, is there an implied assignment of authority somewhere? And if there is, then that's just as if there were an explicit assignment of authority, right? And if the employer is acting within that explicit assignment, the employer's okay.
But the whole problem with that premise is that 18D really doesn't cover...
Stop. I want to get the background principles right. Then
okay,
we can look at 18D, okay? So what is there something wrong with my formulation of the background principle?
No, if what I'm understanding is that if you have a provision that has some kind of correlation or a relationship to an authority that has to met out that provision, is that what you're saying?
No, it's just in this component of covered by, we don't have to find something exactly dealing with it. We have to look at the agreement as a whole,
right,
and see what it reasonably meant.
Right.
Right. Okay.
Okay. So in
so
this,
if
I'm sorry,
if the agreement, if 18D reasonably means that essentially the warden has, I guess, complete discretion in terms of posting the blank roster, then until we get to the question of whether Central grabbed that authority, then it would be covered by 18D. You read 18D differently.
Right. And,
okay.
And I believe that 18D was negotiated for the orderly process of dealing with how employees bid for posts and are scheduled for work assignments on a quarterly basis only after the warden,
right,
decides what posts to go in there to begin with. So what the Mission Critical initiative did was not anything to do with how employees bid for posts and the orderly assignment on a quarterly basis.
The contention of the Bureau is that all the stuff about how we work it out once we have a blank roster is the implementation and impact of the warden's designation of posts.
Right. And what the Mission Critical instead did was nothing to do with how these posts are ultimately decided for the quarter. It dealt with a whole reallocation of posts so that there were elimination of posts, and these were in every prison, according to the memorandum and the record. And that really has nothing to do with procedures and scheduling.
I understand your argument.
What is our standard of review of the authorities covered by determination here? Is it de novo or is it abuse of discretion?
I believe it's a very narrow standard under 706 of the APA, and I think as long as in the NTEU case, as long as our interpretation of the covered by doctrine is reasonable, the court should affirm the authority's decision.
You just said a second ago, nothing in 18 or 18D has to do with scheduling and something else, what'd you say?
Well, nothing, 18D.
Pardon me, has only to do with
exactly
scheduling,
right.
And what else did you say?
Has to do with scheduling assignments and bidding and employees bidding for assignments.
Isn't it the case, though, that before this initiative, wardens could make and did make reallocations and as needed, and move some positions or posts from one roster to another?
They did, but what happened here was even greater, because there were in this initiative permanent positions, merit positions that were now, who never were in second annual rosters, they were relegated to being in a much larger pool to bid for these quarterly assignments.
Well, this is sort of the argument that the exercises of discretion in the past had only de minimis impact, and
right.
Now they have
it's a much greater impact. And the impact, most disturbingly, was on the increase in inmate-to-inmate violence and inmate-to-prison guard violence. And I think that it's important to note that in all the fact findings of the arbitrator laying out this much more than de minimis impact and laying out what the initiative was in terms of that it was a direction, not guidance, none of these fact findings were accepted by the agency. And so they are supported by the evidence, and in this court, when it's supported by substantial evidence under 7123C, it is conclusive.
The only evidence, though, whether it's substantial or not, the only evidence that the wardens retained their discretion after the rescission of the first clarification of the first memo is the testimony at 307, correct?
That they didn't retain.
Saying they didn't. That they still had to submit to the regional managers.
That is.
That's the only evidence, and the argument is that's substantial or sufficient anyway, mm-hmm. to establish
to
the point.
Establish mm-hmm. a
is there any
conclusion.
The testimony of that person indicating how he knew, laying a foundation, to put it technically.
What was happening in the field? How did he know?
Yes. What was because he has two roles. He was a prison guard officer for 16 and a half years. And
in one institution?
In one institution.
So he knows what's
going
on there.
And he had national he had a national role in the union. So he got anecdotal remarks from many people in the prison system of what was going on. And again, the agency never accepted to any of these facts, so they are conclusive.
Did you participate in assembling the joint appendix?
I can't hear.
Did you participate in assembling the joint appendix for this case?
Somewhat, yes.
Well, then perhaps you know how big is the record before the arbitrator?
It wasn't that big.
And the full record before the authority?
Was about the same, yeah.
I think it would be helpful if you would submit a copy of everything to the court. Can you do that in the next 10 days?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And, of course, you'll copy counsel.
Yes. And for reasons stated today and for the reasons in my brief, we respectfully ask that the court affirm the decision of the Federal Labor Relations Authority.
Thank you, Ms. Friedman. Mr. Sherrod, is there anything that the court will be deprived of if we don't hear it from you again?
Well, I just want to say doctrinally, the impact part of this comes only after the court determines, or rather the arbitrator and the authority determines that there is no covered by
a defense. Yes, we've been back and forth with both of you on that.
Right, and so that, for example, the finding that it's not covered by then leads to a question of whether the impact is de minimis or not. If it's de minimis, then there's no violation for not bargaining. So
I don't think you argued it was de minimis, did you?
No, but the point I'm trying to make is the cover by it is the first question. You don't get to this impact question until you've answered whether 18 is the provision which covers this question. And I just wanted to mention a few citations in response to questions.
Citations would be helpful if you would give them in writing to the courtroom deputy clerk.
Okay. These are just to the joint appendix. That's all. The extended date of the contract when it's not been renegotiated is Article 42 at page 124 of the joint appendix.
And is it extended for a term or indefinitely?
Indefinitely.
Is it the case, as FLRA counsel suggested, that we have a factual finding not accepted to by you that this shifted authority from the wardens to central?
And we rely on, that's why we don't think that.
Is that the case? I mean, I guess not.
No, because our essential position is that the arbitrator himself found what we wanted to be found, namely that the decision remained with wardens. And that was the critical aspect of the so-called mission critical initiative, was that first it looked like it was the regional directors, but he found, notwithstanding the provision,
the bracketed section in the quote from the
right, because he was quoting the Vanier memorandum, and then he recognized that the Vanier memorandum was something that occurred in 2004, was corrected so that the way the initiative worked, if we can call it that, was that it still left with wardens the authority they always had. And so the testimony that you cited, page J, the Joint Appendix 307, from the union president, did not win over, in our view, the arbitrator's ultimate finding on that issue. And then, of course, in the end, when he's awarding the remedy, he argues again, or states again, that all the mission critical initiative did was suggest, and he uses the word suggest, that to wardens as to which positions or posts should be included in the blank rosters.
So you had no reason, you say, to file an exception?
We had no reason to file exceptions to the findings.
Another reason that we would like to see the full record. We've got these bracketed phrases and incomplete memoranda and so on.
Much of that is also in the transcripts, and we cite to much of the transcript provisions in our brief regarding these very points about the authority of wardens, et cetera. And the and so those citations from the transcript, and the entire transcript is in the joint appendix, we've made in our brief. So I just wanted to point that out to
the court. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Friedman, thank you. The case is submitted, and the court will take a brief